beginning at verse 29, and the lawyer, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead." Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So, likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii, 2 pence, and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, "Take care of him. Whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back." Which of these three do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? He said, "The one who showed mercy on him." Jesus said to him, "Go, keep on doing likewise." You see, Jesus took this man out of his world, out of his world of theory and theology, and took him into another world, into a world known to ambulance drivers and to police sergeants, the people who worked at the emergency rooms of hospitals. He took him into a world where folks get robbed and raped and murdered. And it was in that world that he found the answer to the question, "Who is my neighbor?" Now, if you and I are going to understand these stories that Jesus told, one thing is absolutely essential, and that is that we get the right point of view. It was Helmut Thielicke, the noted German theologian, who said that in studying the parables, the viewpoint is everything. And too often, when we come to these stories, we see them from the outside in, as stories that took place in the long ago and far away, in another time and climate. And as long as they are ancient stories about the past in Palestine, we really will not see them for what we are, for what they are. Thielicke said that when his son was just a babe in arms, he took his child and held it up in front of a mirror. And the baby moved, and of course the reflection moved. The baby waved and the reflection waved, and then suddenly the child's face lit up and it recognized that that's there, that's me. And you'll discover that as you read these stories of Jesus. When you first look at them, it looks like black print on a white page. But sometimes the print has a way of fading and changing, and there on the page of the scripture you discover there's a mirror. And there in the mirror, you find the picture of yourself. The viewpoint is everything. The question, then, is who is my neighbor? And if we're going to answer that question, whose point of view should we take? Well, one possible point of view would be the point of view of this man who had been mugged by the robbers and was left by the side of the highway to die. I imagine that if we went up to that man and said to him, "Pardon me, sir, we're taking a survey, and we wonder if you could give us a bit of help. We would like to know, whom do you consider your neighbor to be?" I'm convinced that that man's answer would have been as wide as the world. Just about anybody coming down the Jericho Road would qualify very nicely. Anybody willing to stop, anybody willing to lend a hand, would have all that it took to be a neighbor. It's strange, isn't it? When our car breaks down, and we don't have a wrench, and we can't get the thing started, anybody coming down the highway willing to stop to lend a hand qualifies completely as being a neighbor. It's when we're in the car and the other man's beside the road that we begin to define this term like a shyster lawyer. Several years ago, when my son Tori was just a small boy, we were were coming home from Sunday school. And I asked him what the Sunday school lesson was about, and he told me it had been about the Good Samaritan. I asked him what he'd learned, so he gave me a blow-by-blow account of all that took place on the Jericho Road. And I said, well, now, sorry, what was the spiritual lesson behind that story? I caught him off guard for a moment, and he thought, and he said, well, that story teaches that whenever I'm in trouble, you've got to help me. And while that may not be the total lesson of the story, at least he had one point of view. He had the point of view of the chap beside the road. But then, of course, Jesus tells us that there were other men who came down that Jericho Road that day. The first two that he introduces us to were a priest and a Levite. And if this man beside the road was compiling a list of candidates for neighbors and convinced that the priest and the Levite would have been at the top of the list, tradition tells us that before they left their home in the morning, these men recited these two great verses: "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and soul and strength and mind, and your neighbor is yourself." So here came these two religious men. Certain, they knew the scriptures, they knew the verses, they had the theology. Who better to qualify as neighbor? But Jesus tells us that when the priest came by, he looked at the man and passed by on the other side. Now, it's hard, isn't it, for us to identify with that priest. It just doesn't seem like our kind of folk passing by this poor man in need. He seems a lot more like those folks up in Queens, New York, who looked out of their window and saw a young woman being beaten to death and didn't even bother to reach over and pick up the phone to call the police. But certainly not our crowd. Certainly not like folks we know. But the reason that we feel that way, of course, is that we're still on the outside looking in. Because I'm sure that if you had talked to that priest, he would have had some good sound reasons, or at least reasons that sounded good, for doing what he did. And I suspect that in his case, he would have had reasons that went back to the Old Testament. I imagine he would have said that back in the book of Leviticus, the scripture said that if a priest touched a dead body, he would be ceremonially defiled. He would have to go through the rites of cleansing before he could serve in the tabernacle again. Perhaps he would say, you know, I wanted to help this man. I really did. But as I looked at him, I realized that he might already be dead. Or I could get involved and he could die in my arms. And then I'd have to go through the rites of cleansing and people would begin to ask questions and it could be quite damaging. So because I must have this holy reputation, I felt it better to pass him by. Now, I admit, I do not know that he thought that way. But I know that whether he thought that way or not, we do. There is a Christian doctrine that is sometimes called the doctrine of separation. And the way that doctrine is sometimes spun is something like this. There are people all around me who obviously have needs, but they're not our kind of folk. I mean, they use language I do not approve of, and they have habits that I do not commend, and they go places that I do not go to. They have attitudes that I do not like. And if I get involved with those people on too close a level, I could be identified with them, and I could hurt my testimony, whatever that might be. Therefore, often in the name of holiness, we pass by the very man who needs our help. The second man down the road was a Levite. If the priest was like the elder in the church, then the Levite was like a deacon. And the Levite was in charge of the services and seeing to it that things were arranged. And Jesus says that he came down the road, and the intimation of the text is that he actually looked more closely and then passed by on the other side. Again, it's interesting to speculate why he passed the man by. Perhaps he thought, like Elder, like Deacon. The elder doesn't have time to stop. I certainly don't have time to stop. I'm busier than he is. Or perhaps something like this went through his mind. He said, you know, I'm on my way to Jerusalem, and there's a group of folks down there waiting for me to speak to them. I've got to give my message on neighbor love, and they're all there, and I'd like to stop and help this man, but, you know, the crowd is waiting. So I think maybe what I'll do is jot him down on a 3x5 card as an illustration. And I can use it as an illustration, and I can challenge the young people to start a Jericho Road Missionary Society and send them back here to help people on a road like this that need help. Again, I confess, I do not know that he thought that way. But I know that whether he thought that way or not, we often do. There is a kind of arithmetic that we indulge in our churches, which is the numbers game that has been spawned in hell. It's the arithmetic that gets so concerned with reaching a world that it misses the individual. So concerned with the masses that it misses the man. We can be so concerned about crossing oceans to reach people in distant continents and become totally unconcerned about crossing the street to reach the man who lives next to us. We can be desperately concerned with Africans in Africa and miss the Negro in the ghetto on the other side of town. So concerned with the multitudes that we miss the individual. But the third man down the road was a Samaritan. If the priest and the Levite were at the top of the list of candidates for neighbor, then the Samaritan was at the bottom of the list. Because the Jews and the Samaritans hated each other. In fact, they had a long-standing feud. Whenever the Jews talked about the Samaritans, they just referred to them as dogs. Everybody knew exactly who was meant. Just as we can refer to people as coons, and we know who we mean. And yet Jesus said that when the Samaritan came down the road, he saw the man, and he was filled with compassion. And he went to him and cleansed the wound with oil and wine and bound it up, put the man on top of his donkey and took him to a hotel and sat up with him through the night, paid the room rent and became surety for the rest. And Jesus turned to this young theologian and said, tell me, of those three men on the Jericho road, who was the neighbor? The two who knew the verses or the man who helped? He, not willing to say the word Samaritan, but the one who showed mercy on him. Jesus said, go. Keep on doing likewise. And from this story, told in the long ago, Jesus answers our question today. But he is telling us something that is both simple and sublime. He is saying that our neighbor is anyone whose need we see, whose need we are able to meet. It is as simple and as profound as that. Your neighbor is anyone whose need you see, whose need you are able to meet. It's obvious that there are certain things about neighbor definition that Jesus puts out that we usually include in. For example, your neighbor may be somebody you do not know. There is no intimation that the Jew and the Samaritan had ever met each other before. One of the marks of the love of Jesus Christ displayed to his people has been their missionary concern. To go to people that they did not know because there were needs they did know, to reach out and touch them. Your neighbor may be somebody who is unfriendly. The Jews and the Samaritans were deep enemies. Your neighbor and mine may be somebody who slams the door in our face, somebody who is rude and crude, somebody who is unfriendly. Your neighbor may be somebody who is unlovely. There is nothing particularly attractive about a man lying by the side of a dirt road in a pool of blood. And your neighbor may not be a lovely person. There is always that temptation, isn't there, to love people like ourselves, the folks who have our lifestyle, who wear our cut of clothes, who have our kind of house. We like to associate with them, but your neighbor may not be that attractive. And your neighbor may be unrewarded. There is no hint in the story that this Jew ever paid the Samaritan back for what he did. There is often that corruption of Christian love, too. The corruption that loves people not because of what we can do for them, but because of what they can do for us. After all, we have a building program and we need folks to help us shoulder the load. Or it's encouraging to see things happen and to watch things grow, and there can be a deep satisfaction of bringing people in. The satisfaction may be completely mine rather than theirs. Your neighbor may be someone who can do nothing for you. Because your neighbor is anyone whose needs you see, whose needs you are qualified to meet. And by information, I think Jesus tells us something of what it will cost to be a neighbor. For example, he tells us that it may take time. Frankly, that I gather from the story comes because the Samaritan must have been something like us. He was a man on a journey. My wife and I have enjoyed 17 happy years of marriage. 17 out of 20 isn't bad. We've had some adjustments during those. We've had some adjustments during those 3 years. And one of the adjustments that we have had comes when we go on trips. Now, you men will understand exactly what I mean, but when we go on a trip, getting in a car is to get there. But it's, 600 miles a day is a perfectly sane number of miles to cover. And my wife has never understood that. I'm willing to stop for gas stations and restaurants, but she likes to look at the road signs to find out what happened. There's always been that bit of friction deciding how far we go in a day. The Samaritan was not traveling the Jericho Road as a Sunday afternoon tourist. He was going somewhere. But in order to be a neighbor, he had to stop and give time. He had to get involved. But I must confess that that's the hardest thing I have to give. I would far rather throw a check in the plate and ask somebody else to do it. But to give time myself to folks who need my help. He got involved. Didn't just call for an ambulance. He got there by the side of the road and got his hands dirty with this man's needs. And it cost him money. He paid 2 pence, and a penny in the day in which this was written was equal to 1 day's wage for a manual laborer. So he paid the hotel rent and became surety for the rent. Often to be a neighbor means that I must get involved with people. I must give them time. I must give them money. And I give time and money and energy to people that are unknown or unfriendly or unlovely or unrewarded. Simply because my neighbor is anyone whose need I see, whose need I am able to meet. But there's a hooker in that, isn't there? When you say that your neighbor is anyone whose need you see, whose need you are able to meet, there's a fudge factor there. And that's in the phrase, your neighbor is anyone whose need you see. Because if you look at the story, you will discover that Jesus points out that all three of these men saw the wounded traveler. For example, in verse 31, he says, "And by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And so likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion on him." So all three of these men saw exactly the same thing. They saw a man who had been beaten up by bandits and left for dead. But the reality, of course, is they really didn't see the same thing at all. One man may have seen a ceremonial defilement. Another man may have seen an illustration. The Samaritan saw a man in need. But you see, there is another truth embedded in this story, and it is this: what you are determines what you see. And that's always true, isn't it? You and I go to an art museum, and you understand and appreciate art, and I am defective in that area. And so we stroll through the halls, and you say, "Robinson, you see that picture? That's art." And I say, "That's art?" Same picture, just different people. What we are determines what we see. All three of these men saw exactly the same scene, but all three did not see the same thing. Only one saw a man in need. When I was growing up, I memorized some of those nasty little verses that we have over in 1 John. You know those verses that say that if a man says he loves God but loves not his brother, he's a liar? Because if he does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he talk about loving God whom he's not seen? And I used to think, even though I memorized the verses dutifully, that that was a bit of pious nonsense. It seems to me utterly ridiculous to talk about my love for my brother and my love for God and putting the two together and saying that if I don't love my brother, I don't love God. Because actually, I didn't feel I had much problem loving God. After all, God was always kind and gracious. He was always working my side of the street. He was always benevolent towards me. I had no problem loving him. But my brother, that was something else. I mean, he'd say nasty things about me behind my back. He had something wrong with his personality. It always rubbed me raw. He turned the radio up loud when I was trying to study. He was always getting in my way. And here John says that if I do not love him, I do not love God. And I thought the whole thing was nonsense. But then as I studied the scriptures, I discovered that I was wrong and that John was right. But you see, when you turn to the scriptures, you discover one outstanding truth. That is that Christian love is not objective. It is subjective. The Christian love does not reside in the person out there. It resides in the person in here. The Christian love does not depend on the person being loved. It depends on the person doing the loving. And it actually is not true that by myself and of myself I love God. That is absolutely false. By myself and of myself, the heart is a rebel and turns away from God. And the only way in which I am able to love God is that the love of God himself, through his Spirit, is shed abroad in my heart, and I am enabled to love God because God's love flows through me. And the point of the New Testament is that the same love that enables me to love God enables me to love my brother and my neighbor. The same love that has a vertical dimension towards heaven has a horizontal dimension towards men. And to talk about loving God and not loving my neighbor, that becomes pious nonsense. That's what I am. Deep inside, because of the work of the Holy Spirit, will determine what I see. What I see will determine what I do. It is because God enables me to love Him that I am enabled to love my brother. And you see, Jesus was going back to this lawyer. He had no problem with his love for God. He thought he had God in a box, and that was all taken care of. His problem, he thought, was with his neighbor. Jesus is saying to him, if you ask nice, neat questions about the definition of neighbor, so that you can exclude people from your responsibility to love, that kind of question tells me two things. It tells me something about your love for your neighbor, something about your lack of love for God. If we are able to love God, we can love our brother and our neighbor too. For what I am will determine what I see. What I see will determine what I do. That's a great truth. It's in the fabric of the New Testament. Remember that poem that we learned when we were children? How does it go? Pussycat, pussycat, where have you been? I've been to London to see the Queen. Pussycat, pussycat, what saw you there? I saw a wee mouse sitting under her chair. Now, of all of the cities in the world that I have ever visited, I think that London was probably the greatest. There was the Tower of London with the blood of history soaking its brick. There was the Westminster Abbey, cradling its historic dead. There was Buckingham Palace and the changing of the guard and the residence of the Queen. Here's a cat that's in there. And now she's back home and she's showing the slides and everybody's gathered around and they say, Pussycat, did you get to the palace? She said, oh yes, I was at the palace. In fact, I was inside. Well, Pussycat, you were inside. Was the Queen there? Oh yes, the Queen was in residence. Did you happen to see her? Oh, yes, I was there in the throne room when the Queen was there. Well, Pussycat, what did she look like? I mean, how was she dressed? What did she wear? How tall is she? The cat says, I didn't notice. He didn't notice. Well, what in the world did you see? Well, underneath her chair was one of the nicest little mice you would ever want to see. Why? She had a pussycat heart. And to a pussycat, mice are more important than queens. What you are determines what you see. And what you see determines what you do. And the love of God is shed abroad in our hearts. It enables us to love God whom we have not seen. But it always enables us to love our brother whom we have seen. Do you love God? Splendid. But do you love your neighbor? For if we do not love our brother who is there, how do we love God when we do not see Him? Let's pray. Our Father, when we come to talk about evangelism, all too often it becomes a duty, something we must do simply because we are Christians and it's the club rule. You realize that that's foreign to your heart and foreign to the motive of the Scriptures. You realize we're dealing with something far more basic, and that is the whole love of God shed abroad in our heart, a love that enables us to love the brotherhood and enables us to love the neighborhood. deeply down inside our Father, that's what we want to be. Loving people. With your love expressed in a myriad of ways to those around us. So we do not ask that you would simply touch our eyes to give us vision, but that you would touch our hearts to give us love. Change us so that what we are will determine what we see. And what we see will then determine what we do. For Jesus' sake, and the sake of folks who have to live with us, we ask.